Well, I'm Mark, and I've been working with Indie Media in the Bay Area for over 9 years now. And I actually got started with Indie Media on the East Coast in DC, so I was a transplant out to the Bay Area right after that. And so I just wanted to basically tell some stories of what Indie Bay has done over the years and some like legal battles and things like that we've gone through. So Indie Bay got started right after the LA IMC, and we actually forked our website code base from the LA Indie Media code, which was called LA Active, and we called ours SF Active. And the original Indie Media code from, you know, Australia and Seattle and all the people that basically launched the Indie Media concept, that code base was called Active. So these are all kind of like forks of this ancient, mostly PHP code called Active. And so the code base was actually forked, you know, on laptops in the backseat of a car driving back up from the LA DMC. I wasn't actually around, but it came down from San Francisco. So at the time in 2000, one of the biggest issues going on in the Bay Area was the housing crisis, as it was called. Of course, this was caused in large part by the dot-com boom, which then ended up being the dot-com bubble, which burst. And so over a period of years, the rents had increased, and a lot of families were driven out of San Francisco to other suburbs and so forth. And so the media wasn't really covering this ongoing gentrification, and media activists got together around the time that the media started, and they launched this housing project webpage. And initially, it didn't have any kind of interactive open publishing features. It was just covered, writing articles, doing interviews, taking pictures, and putting it up on the web. And then in 2000, we were able to like merge all of that work into an open publishing indie media website, which was sf.indiemedia.org and also indiebay.org, two URLs going to the same website. So this is just a sample of the housing page, but when the indie media site launched, we had all kinds of fancy functionality that we were kind of experimenting with. We actually allowed anybody to create an account on the site and rate articles, either positive or negative. So every story that came in would have tons of votes up or down. But this ended up being completely useless for us because it was just ballot stuffing. People would basically create accounts and then downvote actually good stories. Mostly it was like malicious downvoting. And we didn't really have time to dive into, you know, building the kind of fancy logic that there are websites that rely on voting that it's called like crowdpowered or crowdsourced or whatever that exists now. And but they spent years like tinkering with algorithms to figure out how to allow people to log in and vote on things and have karma. So some people have more weight in the voting than others. But we kind of just gave up on some of the interactive features and decided that we would just have an editorial collective that would maintain the website. And I think a lot of other media sites over time did that too, so we were just kind of blending in with the crowd. So we really quickly reached out to people organizing on all kinds of other issues besides the housing crisis. And so this is not from our early years, this is I think from like 2005 or something, but this is new. At San Quentin Prison. Prison industrial complex has been an ongoing story in California because California has the biggest prison system in the world, basically, definitely per capita. I don't know how it compares to China overall, but so we actually formed a working group of people working on the prison industrial complex issue and media activists. People doing radio at KPFA, people writing articles for the Bay Guardian, like a local news weekly. And, you know, I actually sat down in the same room and tried to figure out how we could all collaborate to create coverage, like an ongoing media project. And so this led to a page on the eBay website which also we decided to merge with the general police brutality topic, because it's pretty related. So, and that's an ongoing section on the site today that we're in. And forest defense was interesting also mentioned there, but basically we tried to collaborate a lot with people on the North Coast organizing about around clear cutting. So in April 2001, there was a global indie media gathering in San Francisco, which we were basically we sort of helped organize it, but a lot of people from other places did most of the organizing work, even though they weren't from San Francisco. So it was like people just parachuted into town, and this huge gathering was kind of like self-created out of nowhere. And people from Seattle, and Chris was there from LA, and lots of folks. And so one of the
Australia too.
Australia, yeah. So all over the world, but I'm just so. I think one of the things that we were really pushing for at that time was network unity and creating some kind of criteria of how do you create an indie media center, and are there any basic principles that we need to reach consensus on now before indie media goes in the wrong direction? What if somebody wants to create a commercial website or institute a really top-down hierarchical structure in their local IMC? So we laid out all these principles of unity, and theoretically we all agreed on them, although they were still called the draft principles of unity for a long time. So it's kind of an ongoing global organization process that hasn't ever finished, but that's okay. So we decided to open up a space in 2001, because this is what was going on in some other cities like Seattle, and we really needed to be able to collaborate in person, and especially as far as giving access to all the tools, whether it's video editing or even just online access. It was really important to have a physical space, and this really helped us launch other projects like video projects and things like that, because we could actually work on them in the same space together. And this also led to a lot of events, because then we had to pay rent, so then we had to have fundraisers. So we had lots of shows and video screenings. And we actually still have a closet in the Redstone building in San Francisco, but that's all we can afford these days as far as rent. We are no longer paying for the... I think at our peak we had like 3 offices in the Redstone building, but it was quite expensive to be paying that month by month, so we've kind of downsized our real estate. And this is around the same time as 9/11, so this is when the anti-war movement really started taking off in San Francisco. And IndieBay was a huge part of covering that. I mean, obviously the local media was forced to cover the anti-war protests going on then, but I think IndieBay was definitely the place where not only activists, but anybody who just wanted to find out what was going on, they would Google, San Francisco peace protest, and they would immediately be taken to indie media. And we actually were able to help force the corporate media and the police to give fair crowd counts, because we were able to go up, in this case, I think it was a helicopter.
Yeah.
Some people were even doing aerial fire-pit planes, but we went up and were able to, Peter Maiden, one of our photographers, was able to take pictures of the entire march going down, all the way down Market Street, that's the fair building. This is probably a couple miles, I don't even know how far it is. This isn't even the end of it, because then it's going into Civic Center Plaza, a huge plaza that can hold at least 50,000 people. So we were able to figure out that this march had 250,000 people. That involves some academics who had had some sort of systematic way to do crowd counts, but the police had estimated only 55,000 people were there all day. So, that's a huge difference in terms of headlines and, convincing people that everyone is protesting and they need to get out on the streets. So, that was huge, and that it was really only this photography that finally led to the Chronicle having huge headlines about, oh, there's over 250,000 people in the streets. And that took a few months of, hard work and actually getting in a helicopter. So, as I was saying, we get a lot of our readership through Google, because this is just how people find information online, unfortunately. So I just threw this up because you can see that this is which websites our traffic is coming from. And so most of our traffic comes from IndieBay. That's just people following links on the IndieBay site itself. But by far, you know, all the top four external sites are Google. And then you have Yahoo and the Microsoft Bing thing. But and then Facebook is kind of far down, actually. But that's kind of been going up over the years. So it's been really important to make sure all the articles and videos and photos are getting indexed by Google. And we actually had a lot of issues with Google News back in the day because they early on added the Bay Area media site to the index, which we were really happy about. But then there was a sort of organized campaign by right-wing folks to constantly email complaints to Google News about this, you know, biased news source being indexed. And they actually, this is conjecture, but it seems like what happened was they were intentionally taking legitimate news articles and putting inflammatory titles on the top of them so that they would be indexed by Google News and then would appear on the front page of news.google.com. And then they could issue their complaints and the Google executives would take them seriously. So in May 2003, they actually removed us from Google News completely, and we had to get on the phone with them, and we actually had a conference call with Marissa Mayer, who was basically one of the top vice presidents at Google. And she's kind of the public face of Google. She speaks at a lot of events. She was the head of Google News at the time. But it actually ended up taking almost a year for them to restore us to the index. The issue came down to hate speech. They claimed that there's words on IndieBay articles like Zionazi, which are hate speech against Zionists, not against Nazis. But meanwhile, we found a lot of blogs that were being indexed by Google News that used words like raghead and Islamofascist, and these weren't being taken out of the Google News index. And so the fact that we were kind of arguing about this is kind of what led, I think, to Google digging in its heels and not being nice to us. Until many months later when finally they gave in and restored us. So.
What kind of power do you have to make them do anything, though?
Well, I mean, there was definitely an online campaign of people, you know, complaining to Google about the fact that they were censoring us. And I think that helped a lot. But, I mean, basically, for months, I would just send emails, like, asking them to restore us to the index, you know, basically every 2 weeks, and I would leave messages on Marissa Mayer's, you know, with her receptionist. So, I think it's just being persistent. Eventually, it'll kind of flow over, and they'll forget why they dropped you a year ago. This is showing how we actually still, this is a view of the Webmaster Tools at Google, and you can see a lot of the articles that we have still get rejected by Google News because it doesn't meet their standards for what a news article should look like or how it should be worded. So we have a lot of stories that the dates are too old. Google News only wants to cover news that's within the last 2 days. They basically only want hard news. They don't want analysis about events that happened a few weeks ago or even like 3 or 4 days ago is too long. So a lot of our articles are rejected. I mean, the ones that are written by the editorial collective, oftentimes we're really busy, we're slow. It takes us a few days to compile all the posts about a protest or some other event and put it up on the site. So a lot of those blurbs never get indexed by Google. And then sometimes they're fragmented because, you know, we have like too many pictures or something. So I haven't done the math, but basically a fair percentage of articles are still rejected from Google News.
How many pictures?
Yeah.
Do they reference your newswire or just things that you've chosen to feature, or what do they look at to see what they're going to?
Well, with Google News, you can in the Webmaster Tools, you can basically tell Google News what feeds of stories you want them to index, and you can have multiple feeds. So we have them index our features, and we have them index basically the promoted newswire articles, which are the ones that we promote as either local news or global news. And everything else we keep down in the like other category. Or there's also a corporate repost category, because sometimes we want to allow certain corporate reposts on the site just because it might be the only coverage that we have about something. But we don't want it to be indexed by Google News, because then we'd be accused of copyright violation or something. So I just wanted to give a little, in case anybody here hasn't seen We Interrupt This Empire. This is a documentary that Indie Media folks in the Bay Area worked on in 2003 about the anti-war movement, which in March 2003 we basically shut down the city. And you know, Indie Media was basically the only source for second-to-second coverage of what was going on, both on the radio and on the website. So I'll just show the trailer. It's pretty fast, but let's see if the sound is on.
This is the day of reckoning.
Policemen that was shut down downtown San Francisco.
Fremont, they got it all shut down.
Yeah, they've also taken over Bell Street. They got more than what we can handle here.
What
if tomorrow the war could be over? Isn't that worth fighting for? Isn't that worth dying for?
We Interrupt This Empire was collaboratively made mostly in the actual Indie Media space in the Redstone building. And it's broken up into a series of like 5-minute sub-features that were made by like mini collectives. And then they basically put it all together with some sort of segues in between to tie it together. And yeah, I mean, it's a great example of collaborative filmmaking. And I wouldn't recommend doing that all the time. It's probably better to have director and the editor just, you know, doing it all in most cases. But it was great just for me. I wasn't a big part of it, but I contributed some footage of like the INS building that was smashed up in San Francisco. So that was all of it. So also, I mean, 2003 was like a crazy dramatic year for us for some reason. We also had a big tip with T-Bold, which is the company that is kind of infamous for making the electronic voting systems. And they are still around, but they changed their name. Does anybody know? I mean, Diebold still exists. They make ATM machines. But they basically renamed the voting machine division some other name that I forgot. But so you should still like keep tabs on them, because they're still Diebold and they're still out there. But they're not called Diebold anymore. But basically, sorry, some people already know the story, but in 2003, it was discovered that Diebold had a public FTP server with all of their internal memos. They weren't actually internal because they were on a public FTP server. And all, you know, emails and specifications and actual software, you could like download the source code and the you know, Microsoft Access database files and all kinds of jerry-rigged ways that they had these voting machines working. So people immediately mirrored all the FTP servers and reposted them onto the web, and then posted links to IndieBay. And we were basically the number one Google hit for people to find the Diebold memos, although they had actually posted links on other sites too. It's just that eBay had like a really high Google ranking. So Diebold immediately sent a DMCA takedown to our upstream internet service provider. And the DMCA is basically a law that, I mean, it has a lot of evil parts to it. It basically criminalizes, you know, any attempts to break DRM systems, or any attempts to basically hack or like reverse engineer, you know, all kinds of devices and software.
Can you say what those two things stand for?
DMCA.
Yeah.
Oh, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And the DRM is Digital Rights Management. So, but I mean, the DMCA isn't necessarily all bad, because there's certain things in it that we can take advantage of. So that's what we did in this case, because there's a provision in there that if a company misuses the DMCA fraudulently, then they're liable for damages and attorney's fees and everything else. So our upstream provider was a nonprofit called Online Policy Group. So they were people who were well-versed in online laws and regulations. So they worked with EFF to sue Diebold, and they actually won a year later $150,000 of damages against Diebold. And so we didn't pay for our web hosting for a while because we figured that we basically donated to our upstream provider $150,000. But so that was a great victory against Diebold, and I mean they ended up, after all the negative publicity, you know, people were making like fake ads and stuff, and that's why they had to rebrand and change their name. So.
Awesome.
Just a question.
Yeah.
So Diebold sent the takedown notice, and then what happened after that?
Well, people didn't follow. I mean, we didn't follow the takedown request.
Okay.
All right. We talked to EFF. EFF was kind of.
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah, Electronic Frontier Foundation is their local San Francisco group. So, I mean, I actually hang out with them a lot. Except they don't really tell me what they're doing because, you know, attorney-client privilege, so I never know what they're actually working on. But basically, we were able to get them on the phone, and they suggested that we didn't have any reason to try. I mean, actually, all that eBay had was links. So it was kind of ridiculous to send a DMCA takedown for a link. And so, I mean, this is something that, I mean, it basically set a precedent that other indie media sites or any kind of open publishing site can take advantage of if somebody is fraudulently, or, I mean, maybe not even fraudulently, but just, you know, like wrongfully sending a DMCA takedown. You can threaten them with a huge lawsuit. So, yeah.
But when you say that they sent the notice to your host, I mean, did you have, like, seamless communication with your host about not
following that?
Like, how does that happen with, like, a literal...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's an important question, because, yeah, if you had, like, we actually have the same host as May 1st. I mean, that was mentioned in the last session, basically, that there's a similar DMCA takedown that just happened against May 1st. And they their upstream host is Freaking Electric, which is also where our server was. But the thing is that our IP space wasn't controlled directly by Freaking Electric. It was controlled by somebody in between us and Freaking Electric, Online Policy Group. And Online Policy Group was basically allied. I mean, they're basically, you know, online activists. And I think it's really important, you know, when you're doing a project like indie media, you need to have allies that are going to have your back as far as getting legal threats, because I mean, we get legal threats all the time. And I mean, we've definitely had cases where, you know, it's not always worth talking to a lawyer and you know, going through all the hassle of, you know, fighting legal threats. Sometimes you just comply with the legal notice, unfortunately, because it's by far the easier way to go. But in this case, you know, we were able to have like sort of seamless cooperation because we're all on the same side of the issue.
Where did these links take you? I mean, maybe they had links to something that people already had online?
Yeah, but people had mirrored it, so...
Oh, I see.
People claimed that it was a copyright violation, but basically the judge decided that it wasn't copyright violation because these memos were already public and they were in the public interest because they were directly related to public election.
Okay.
So, it, I mean, luckily we had a prison judge. I could imagine a judge somewhere else or, you know, different politics ruling a different way.
And this was a judge at one level?
A federal judge in San Jose. San Jose seems to handle a lot of the sort of online kind of law, like precedent setting law.
That would make sense to be sort of valid.
So, I mean, this is just an example of a problematic post that you might get on any media site. It's somebody claiming responsibility for killing a police officer for the first, I mean, this is the first time anybody knew for sure that this guy killed a police officer. So, obviously this led to a lot of publicity for IndieBay because all the corporate media was linking to us and saying that, you know, people were posting admissions of killing police officers. So when you get a post like this, I mean, if it's something that law enforcement doesn't have any other information about, they might want to talk to you. They might want to get server locks. You might want to get all kinds of stuff. So we have to deal with bomb threats and things like that being posted to the site occasionally. And then with claims of responsibility, I mean, that's kind of similar, although the I guess the difference is that a threat is that could be a crime itself, just the existence of the threat on the website is a crime. Or claim of responsibility is like something that the authorities might want to track because a crime was committed elsewhere. So, and then there's other kinds of illegal content that could come into existence from time to time because they decide to ban it. Like, I think the PACIBAC had something about information about building bombs or explosives, and I think, in California, we have something about publicizing the home addresses of animal rights researchers is now a crime. And so there could be other kinds of information, like for national security reasons, that is declared to be illegal information or something. So it's just something to be aware of. And I mean, I'm not by any means an expert. And so we just kind of try to figure out on a case-by-case basis how to deal with these kinds of crises when they come up.
Try to keep them down in the, what I call other, what would you call that? Unclassified before you figure out what to do.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's,
yeah, it's weird. Like, if you get a bomb threat, should you promote it as a big headline news story that there's a bomb threat, or do you have to fact check, like, call, like, you really live at this address, like, there's a bomb on the way to your house? I mean, it's weird, you know, like, how do you deal with these kinds of news stories?
Yeah.
So,
make sure you're designed.
So one thing that happened, when did this happen? I think it was in 2004, 2005. But the California Highway Patrol had given us actual CHP press credentials with our photos and names or pseudonyms on them. I don't think they knew that we'd given them pseudonyms, but some people gave them pseudonyms. So the CHP for decades had issued press passes, which would allow the press to get to accident scenes or, but of course the CHP doesn't just do like traffic accidents. They're actually involved in, you know, blocking protests and things like that. So up in Humboldt County, somebody had a CHP press credential and was involved in covering the environmental movement up there, but also involved sort of as a volunteer doing legal work with the environmental movement. And so we had an issue where the Humboldt County Sheriff was really upset about the fact that somebody could be a media activist and like an independent journalist at the same time. So I can hear myself. So the Humboldt County Sheriff sent a letter to the CHP requesting that this reporter's credentials be revoked. And this ended up leading to the CHP questioning the credentials of all the IndieBay journalists. And we actually had to get some lawyers involved in dealing with the CHP because we didn't want to go quietly if the CHP was going to threaten to revoke all of our press credentials. I mean, this has been really useful for me. I mean, mine is expired now, but I'll get to that. But I mean, over the years, it was really useful. I could use it to get into a courthouse for a trial. If the courtroom was completely full, I could still get in and take notes on what was going on in the trial because there was always like reserved seating for the press. Of course, it could also be used to get around riot police lines and things like that. But so we talked to the First Amendment Project, which is basically, you know, a couple First Amendment lawyers, and so they sent a sort of legal threat letter to the CHP about whether or not they could just revoke press credentials for a media organization in light of the First Amendment, and because that's basically would kind of be a very direct contravention of that. So so eventually what happened is the CHP decided to cancel their entire press pass program, and they issued a press release about that, saying that now that anybody on the street could have a camcorder, there was no sense in having press passes. So I guess on the one hand it could be a victory because it showed that, you know, everybody can be a journalist, and that's kind of the end of media mission. On the other hand, we didn't have a get out of jail free card anymore. So you know, that made it a little difficult to get around the right police lines when you only had an expired press pass. But and actually, I mean, there was a lot of articles about this at the time, and I feel like it must have inconvenienced the corporate media, but I never really talked to them about it. So I wanted to mention our newspaper, which I have some like sample issues of, but basically, you can pass this around again. But you had a question?
Yeah, but going back to the CHP thing, so that's if they canceled the program, no press passes?
Yeah.
For any media person or just
any media? For any media, whether you're corporate media or, yeah, a blogger, whatever, nobody can get one. Yeah. You can still get a local police press credential in most places, I think. Yeah, at least in the big cities. So Faultlines was the newspaper that we started in 2004, and initially it had a more newspaper format, and then by the end it had this sort of like magazine format with like a big color cover. But this is really important for us to have like actual writers contributing, you know, well-written articles. Over the years it was really hard for us to find people interested in contributing articles to a website for free, because it just takes a lot of work to research, you know, a lengthy article. And so what we were able to do was convince people that since it was in print, that they should actually write an article and then have, you know, a team of editors to check it for typos and that sort of thing. But basically, you know, Faultlines was sort of the latest in a long line of, you know, radical community newspapers in the Bay Area. And unfortunately, it's no longer with us, because it was a lot. It was basically just a lot of work to run the newspaper, and you know, eventually, people were basically funding the newspaper out of their own pockets, because there was never enough money coming in from subscribers to actually print the entire print run. So I guess it lasted for a couple years. I'm not sure how many issues. I think this is the last issue 21. But it wasn't completely non-commercial, I guess, in the sense that it did have ads from local small businesses, but all the small businesses were like, you know, like radical small businesses like AK Press or somebody like that. So I feel like that's pretty close to, you know, as clean as you can get as far as carrying ads. But another project we had was Street Level TV, and this was a women-run TV show that was on public access cable and on the internet. And I guess, for the people that were involved, I mean, it was just really important for them to have a women-led project. So that's how it was organized from the beginning. And a bunch of them moved away, so it's not around anymore. But, I mean, this was really successful in, you know, getting people to collaborate on edited pieces, because, it's a similar thing to Faultlines. You know, it's a lot of work to edit a piece for YouTube, but people feel like when it's actually going out on you know, satellite TV and cable TV, then, you know, maybe it's worth the effort, you know, all the volunteer labor of doing the video editing. So,
Mark, did you people still feel that way as things change? If it's in a printed paper, it's real and they'll spend more time, or if it's on a public access as opposed to YouTube? I mean, are people blurring those lines now more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, you know, people are more and more into internet video. I mean, that's where most people are watching video nowadays, I guess, at least for the younger generation. But I think it's still, I mean, the whole issue of volunteer media work is still hard for a lot of people to put in the time. So it seems like some way people have to, you know, justify putting in all the hours of slave labor. They want to make sure that they have, like, a large viewership and some, like, recognition for all their hard work, I guess.
I want to see a piece of paper with their name on it as yeah. opposed to on the internet. But actually, get more readership if it's on the internet, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's
I mean,
a psychological thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I mean, personally, I'm really into online media, but it was just clear to me that not everybody wants to be only in the online world. So, Enemy Combatant Radio was like another example of getting offline because we relayed the radio shows onto FM radio. And Enemy Combatant Radio obviously kind of started around the anti-war movement. And we were basically the only source for, you know, minute-to-minute reports of what was going on in the streets. So people could be involved in a protest and have a Walkman and headphones and find out, you know, where's the protest going, where are people getting arrested, and so forth. So it was basically tactical media because it was media that could be used by people that are participating in the action. And so a big part of running Enemy Combatant Radio was having like some kind of base for exchanging information from different sources, because you could have people that are involved in actually organizing a protest. That's one source of information. They might not even be in the streets. The people that might be organizing it might, you know, have some kind of, you know, secret lair where they're like directing all the action. You could have maybe have like a phone line to talk to those people to find out what their plans are, or maybe you have somebody actually there hanging out with them. Another source of information would be police radio. Somebody could listen to the police radio, find out where the police are headed, and relay rumors about what the police might be up to. So that was pretty critical. And this tied directly into our work using text messaging. You know, at some point, finally everybody had a cell phone, except me. I didn't get one until much later. But so we used text messaging kind of before Twitter. I mean, I guess before Twitter really existed, but definitely before it took off. And so TextMob was kind of a precursor to Twitter, where you could create a group and receive text messages about, I mean, it was literally like launched around the street protest idea, which was kind of, I thought, I don't know, gutsy for them to do that. But basically, TextMob was just a website that would relay the text messages out to the phones. And so they didn't even have an API. Like Twitter has an API now where you can build a service on top of Twitter and basically use Twitter as like a vehicle. But, oh, sorry. Yeah, it's a, basically API is like a technical term, like application programmer interface. So
it
yeah, basically API is sort of like a gateway where you could utilize something as a service. So you could use Twitter as if it was like, you know, the post office. Basically you have a way to get a letter into the post office through some like known standard. So that's basically what an API gives you. So TextMob didn't have any kind of way for people to utilize it in the way that we wanted to do. Like basically we wanted to have breaking news being managed by the editors on the IndieBay site. We didn't want to have just anybody be able to contribute breaking news because there's no way to fact check it and to verify it. So we wanted to have a team of editors online at all times, taking in reports and verifying their accuracy and sending them out to the text mob. And so we sort of built our own API, basically our own way to send messages in the text mob from the IndieBay site. So everything was managed through the IndieBay site, but it could relay the breaking news out to text mob. And so this is how people were getting updates about, you know, where the street protests was going and that sort of thing. And 2005 was one of the cases where we were actually using that system. But at the same time, at this anti-G8 protest, Josh Wolf was a big contributor to IndieBay at the time, although, I don't know, I guess he's mostly focused on his own blog nowadays. But Josh Wolf was contributing a lot of videos and was out in the streets at this anti-G8 protest and filmed some police brutality, and also apparently a protester was involved in actually attacking the police, although Josh didn't film that. But because a police officer was injured during the protest, there was a major law enforcement investigation of what had happened at that protest.
Was that in San Francisco?
Yeah, this is in San Francisco. So the San Francisco police and somehow the FBI got involved in the investigation because they claimed it was a terrorist threat. Basically, they really wanted to get Josh Wolf's footage. Of course, they didn't know that he didn't have the footage they were looking for. But Josh Wolf, basically, after receiving a grand jury subpoena for his footage, he refused to turn it over to them. And I guess he had made the mistake of using his name when he posted the video. So they knew it was him. They knew, chances are, he had more video, and they wanted to see all of it. I mean, a lot of times people post the video anonymously, and I think it's a good idea. If you have something that maybe you filmed a crime being committed, or you filmed something right before or right after a crime was committed, it can be dangerous to post that material. But it could be a threat to you, it could be a threat to the person you filmed, or something else. So Josh refused to give the video over to the authorities, and he was in jail for 226 days. And eventually there was some sort of plea bargain reached where I think he did give him the video in the end, because he didn't have any interesting video anyway, so it didn't really matter. So I don't know, the whole thing was just a real mess. But, 5 minutes?
10 minutes, yeah.
Okay, so these are basically some of the, you know, legal questions that I think came up in Josh Wolf's case. And I mean, he sort of set a weird precedent, basically, that you could just sit in jail forever. So we're hoping that, like, this issue will come up again and we can have a better conclusion. Basically, the question is, can journalists refuse to comply with grand jury subpoena? And then also, who is a journalist? You know, if there is any kind of shield law protecting journalists, does that apply to bloggers and independent videographers and so forth? And then there's a lot of cases where the federal government gets involved for really fuzzy reasons. I mean, this was basically a street protest in a, you know, random neighborhood in San Francisco. There was no federal building around the protest. It was really unclear why the federal government was involved in Josh Wolf's case. And I mean, we see other cases like this where the federal government was involved in, for example, the use of Twitter during the RNC protest in St. Paul. I guess the reason they do that is because the federal authorities have certain extra judicial powers to get all kinds of subpoenas and national security letters and things like that. So basically it seems like a tool that law enforcement can use to basically expand the jurisdiction. But I think it's important to try to fight that when it happens. So I just wanted to touch really quickly on the international solidarity work that we've done on IndieBay, because this is like really important to all of us. And so we have really, really good archives of, photo archives of struggles that happened in Lebanon and Oaxaca. And, you know, a lot of these are basically Bay Area folks who are able to fundraise and travel to these places and do a lot of on-the-ground media support work. And Tristan Anderson was one of our really, really prolific volunteers, and he has been unable to post anything to IndieBay for a while because he's been in a hospital bed in Tel Aviv with a massive head injury inflicted by the Israeli Defense Forces. So Tristan was a major protest organizer in the Bay Area, and at the same time, he was a media activist and photojournalist. So he was a great example of, you know, this whole concept of participatory media.
And he should be up on that wall right there,
the
altar.
Yeah. I mean,
dead people up there.
We should have an altar for, you know, people who have been severely injured, for sure. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping that Tristan will pull through, like, all this trauma and someday be back under the bus. So, I guess maybe a few 5 minutes, Dave.
No, you can just go for 10. Okay. We've got time.
Because this is important.
Hey, I'm going to go ahead and start off with a quote from the late, great Harvey Milk, more or less. My name's David, by the way. I'm a volunteer with IndieBay as well, and I'm here to recruit you. I don't know if you're familiar with the case of Oscar Grant, but he was murdered by BART police January 1st. And independent media has been really important there. That's a shot of the BART platform where he was murdered. He and his friends were detained by the police for a supposed fight that was going on. The police were manhandling them, throwing them around on the ground, pulling them by their hair. It was, you know, all white cops, African-American and Latino friends of Oscar Grant. And then a couple days later, video started appearing all over the internet and really just outraged people. So I'll go ahead and show you one of those.
Didn't one of those videos appear on IndieBay?
Yeah, some have been reposted there. You can find them there. Oh yeah, actually, while you're on that topic, I have some flyers here that there's kind of a central repository of coverage that we've created. If you could maybe just take one and pass them on. So check it out and educate yourselves because it's a really important case. Are we ready? Okay, so here's video. It was a train full of people coming home after midnight on New Year's Eve, and everybody had cell phones on them that can record video. There was some high-res video that was shot, but BART actually stole that from one of the passengers, and that's been used in the court trial. But this is one of the cell phone videos that was shot that is publicly accessible. And sure, and then they closed the doors to the BART train and just sent everyone away, hundreds of witnesses, and that's sort of when the police cover-up began. And the cover-up began right there. There was a massive protest on the 7th. You can see the riot police out and the car on fire there. What happened was there was a rally at the Fruitvale BART where he was murdered exactly 7 days the next Thursday. Probably about 1,500 people were there, and then maybe 300 people marched to downtown. Once things got downtown, that's when it got a little hairy. The police were everywhere. There was ended up being over 100 arrests, I think. They sort of did a mass arrest towards the end. Most of the charges have been dropped, but there's still three people facing felonies, and they're pretty much bogus. One guy they're coming after is a big-time activist in the African-American community, and he's still facing felony charges. They're trying to encourage him to plead guilty.
Media activist, right.
J.R. Vowery. And so after this rebellion, you know, there was like a split in the, you know, the corporate media was all like, oh, bad window breakers and car burners. But a lot of people knew that, you know, that the outrage was legitimate. So there was another one planned. People, organizers, ad hoc groups had come together and said, we're going to do this. The cop had not been arrested. Millions of people had seen the video. The cop had not been arrested and was still out free, just doing whatever he wanted. So they said they were going to have a rally every Thursday until, you know, he was charged with the crime. So there was an even bigger rally planned for the 14th. And just before, you can see, you know, there's like Black Block and some local kids on their bikes. And the day before this rally that ended up being attended by over 5,000 people, it was huge, they arrested Meserle, Johannes Meserle. He's the cop who shot Oscar Grant. So pretty much the common wisdom amongst activists in Oakland is that riots were. It led to the first ever charge against the California cop for an on-duty shooting. So it's really, really huge.
Wasn't he in Nevada?
Yeah, he was in Nevada. Apparently his family, he had family house there or something.
So they
knew where he was. So on the 13th, he was arrested to try and avoid, you know, an even huger riot on the 14th. There was some protests of storage windows and things getting broken, but it was not as big as it was on the 7th. It really kind of quieted things down a bit once he was actually arrested. During the different points in his trial, independent media has been really crucial in getting the truth out there. The corporate media has done an absolute horrible job. I'll give you one quick example. We had people inside the courtroom every day reporting what happened, you know, from start to finish, so that we could know the truth of what was really going on. The corporate media, on the other hand, one of the cops who was involved, Marisol Dominici, she kept saying, "Oh, I was so scared. There was hundreds of people on the platform. We were terrified for our lives." You know, of Oscar Grant, who's laying face down with his hands behind his back. And but they showed the video in the courtroom, and they kept saying, "Okay, show us when you see these hundreds of people." And she didn't say anything. And they let the video run the whole way through. She never said she saw all those people, because she couldn't. She was lying. The BART cops were all lying, and some of the others we think should be charged as well. But that's a side story. But anyway, the corporate media, for instance, wrote this one article on that day's hearing, and all it did was quote Marisol Dominici, her fear, how scared she was, blah, blah, blah. And at the very end, it said, and the DA tried to show that she was lying, but that's not at all the way it went down. The DA tore her upside down or whatever through the entire day. Her testimony was total BS. Even the judge was clowning the cops and how obvious they were lying. So it was really, really crucial to have this. All the local police activists could know what was going on. The corporate media just
yeah. Terrible.
So there's a change of venue. The defense is trying to use every trick in the book. The police unions are paying for this cop's defense.
That's right.
So they have unlimited funds to do what they want. And they've been trying to throw hurdles and roadblocks. And one thing they said was, well, there's been, you know, a ton of media coverage on it, which there was, and there's been protests, and then there's groups like IndyBay. This is actually from his change of venue motion, and it cited IndyBay, it cited some of the other activist groups. Basically what they were saying was that we were informing the public too well, that they had to take it to a county that was more ignorant of the case and the truth.
Except we're online. They could read it anywhere. Right?
And they blamed community activists was a part of it as well. And unfortunately, the judge agreed. So the judge said that a trial needed to be moved. A group of judges in San Francisco said that it needs to be held in Los Angeles or San Diego County. So that's why I opened with, "I'm here to recruit you. We need media activists."
On the jury?
That would be nice. But we need media activists who, you know, maybe have, who work in the evenings or whatever, can get to these court hearings in the daytime and take notes and post those online so that we can know the truth. We can't rely on the corporate media, or we're only going to get the cop side of things. And all these cops, these BART cops, are notorious liars. You can go to Indy Media, the thing I handed around, and read a lot about the case. We're going to need housing for activists. So if anybody can spare a couch or a bedroom or has something like that, you know, definitely get in touch. And this is just a hugely precedent-setting case. So any solidarity, we're going to find out on Thursday probably if it's going to be LA or San Diego. This is the first time a cop has ever been charged for an on-duty murder, and we need to make sure that he goes down in the courts. So
you're here.
Get ready, media activists.
Yeah.
Thank
All right.
You.
Did everyone get a flyer?
I
just because you need to start educating yourselves about it. There's a ton of, there's court documents there. It's not just protest photos. You can really learn about the ins and outs of what's gone on so far.
Excellent.
Thank you. Thank you.